Pegida, the anti-Islamization marches that have drawn crowds in the many hundreds of thousands in, throughout Europe, was that it was my conclusion that their animosity wasn't to the religion of Islam. It wasn't based on evidence and reason. It wasn't a moral standing. But in fact was based on combinations of racism, which I'm opposed to, based upon this is mine and I'm not sharing, selfishness, which I'm not opposed to. And number three, that it was based upon this rising neo-Nazi viewpoint that fascism that is being rekindled in Europe, which I'm opposed to. Well, come to find out, at least at the top of the Pegida movement, unfortunately I was right. The head of Germany's anti-Islamization movement, Pegida, has quit after disparaging anti-refugee comments and a photo showing him posing as Hitler. Lutz Bachmann apologized for Facebook comments he made in which he called refugees animals and scumbags. Pegida spokeswoman Catherine Ortel said the anti-refugee comments went too far. However, she thought to play down the Hitler photo as a joke and satire, which is every citizen's right. No. You can't go dress up like Hitler. If you're going to take a position as polarizing as this one. But the German government condemned it. Vice Chancellor Sigmar Gabriel told the Bild, anyone in politics who poses as Hitler is either a total idiot or a Nazi. Reasonable people do not follow idiots, and decent people do not follow Nazis. You know, there's not much that the German government says that I agree with, but Vice Chancellor Sigmar Gabriel Bild, your comments to the Bild were accurate. Anyone in politics who poses as Hitler is either a total idiot or a Nazi. Reasonable people do not follow idiots, and decent people do not follow Nazis. He's right. I was right. Pegida is wrong. They're right in the sense that Islam is bad for everyone, but they're wrong in the reasons behind what they do. And I'm here to tell you that understanding the reason behind things is and for your stand is as important as the stand. You know, it's you don't want to fight fire with fire. Just because you've got somebody that's opposed to that which you're opposed to, you know. Xing Zhu was wrong. The enemy of my enemy is not my friend. You know, you have to make certain that when you're going to take a stand, like my stand is, that Islam ought to be exposed and condemned using a combination of the Islamic scriptures, Muhammad's words and deeds, and his Quran, to expose and condemn him and the religion and Sharia law, which is based upon him, his words and deeds, that he ought to be understood and absolutely repudiated publicly. The Quran ought to be repudiated publicly, and it ought to be plainly declared and known and concluded that Islam is a criminal enterprise, masquerading as a religion. And therefore, it should be illegal, it should be banned, and in foreign countries, it should be quarantined. It should be illegal to do any business with an Islamic country. Can't sell them weapons, can't buy their oil. If we were to do that, we would resolve the issue of Islamic terrorism immediately. The world would become a vastly less deadly, torturous place. and the abuses that are perpetrated on Muslim women would diminish astronomically. Now, I take that position because I know that what I say is absolutely true and can prove it and have proved it. You know, there are a lot of people that, Charlie Hebdo, that criticize Judaism and Christianity. But they do so out of ignorance. And so, while the religions deserve criticism, that criticism is actually counterproductive unless you have evidence to demonstrate that your position is valid. And so, the fact that they're anti-religious at Charlie Hebdo, I'm not going to ally with them. I am not going to say, hold up my little sign and say, we are Charlie. Because I'm not. I don't agree with them on anything important. I mean, I can't even support them in creating the caricatures of a naked Muhammad engaged in repulsive sex, perverted sex, and that's going a long way when you're speaking about the French, or inspiring terrorism, because they don't cite the Quran and Hadith where Muhammad engaged in these things, showing that they're accurate depictions of who he was. They were just doing it because they could in that society, and they didn't like the Islamic response. You know, if you're going to kick the hornet's nest, you darn well better understand the motivation of the hornets, the capability of the hornets, the purpose of the hornets. And you better have a plan that justifies what you're doing. Now, Yahweh had such a plan. He kicked the largest hornet's nets in the world. He did so for the right reasons. He explained his motivations. He explained his concerns about the largest hornet's nest in the world, Christianity. Pauline Christianity. It's a religion based entirely on Paul. It references and gives lip service to a Jesus Christ, but there was no Jesus Christ. God didn't die, much less for your sins. There was no bodily resurrection. These are statements of fact, not opinions, not interpretations. There is no Trinity. God does not have a church. He most certainly doesn't have a cross. There are no Christians in heaven. God exposed and condemned Pauline Christianity. 666 years before Paul wrote his first letter. He called him out by name, called him the plague of death, told us when he would appear, where he would appear, who he would address, claim as his own, what strategy he would deploy. Spoke specifically about his egotistical character. He told us who he would bring as contemporaries to argue against him. Named them by name. He even denoted the primary area of conflict, which would be circumcision. Told us that this was an individual, one individual man, who would contradict Yahweh's requirements and Yahweh's responsibilities, nullifying them, which is precisely what Paul did in his letters. God could not have been any more clear than he was in his prophecy through Chabaok. And he even knew that Paul would cite this passage not once, but twice. Chabaoth, too. Paul cites it not once, but twice. And not just in passing, it's the fulcrum of two of his letters. The very basis of Pauline doctrine is that Torah cannot save, you're saved by faith. And he uses a truncated, erroneously translated statement in Chabaoth 2, which is right where he is named by name as Shaul, as the plague of death, to claim that it is God himself that said that the Torah cannot save, that we are instead saved by faith. The basis of the religion of Christianity, its very foundation, and it comes from the book that condemns Christianity in Paul. We have been making our way through it. We are now at the 13th verse of the second chapter of Chabaoth. Habakkuk is what you'll find it in your English Bible, although it's very poorly translated in English. Chabaoth in Hebrew means embrace this. That means accept this. Hold on to this. Realize that this is something that is reliable, that if you accept, you will be prepared, properly informed. Indeed, Yahweh says, this is reliable and sure. She will fulfill, edify, and completely satisfy the land. To approach, to actually know, and to become genuinely familiar with Yahweh's manifestation of power, glorious presence, and abundant value, similar to the rain, providing a covering for the sea. You might say, well, what does that have to do with Paul? And the fact is, it has a lot to do with Paul. Because Paul negated Yisrael. He was every place but Yisrael. He only came to Jerusalem begrudgingly because he was summoned there. And he renounced it. He is, in his letters, sees no value in Israel and no value in Jerusalem. And yet Yahweh views Jerusalem as the capital, as the heart, of the most important and dearest place on earth. This statement, indeed, this is reliable and true. Key, she will fulfill, edify, and completely satisfy from Mali. Mali was written in the third person singular, so it's a capital she. It says we're talking about the set apart spirit. She will impart an abundance of that which is healthy, valuable, empowering, and satisfying. The one that made Yisrael so vital during the time that Paul was out telling lies to the Gentiles was the set-apart spirit. It was the set-apart spirit on Shavuah that came upon the disciples and those that they had imparted Yahusha's teaching to, that had embraced the terms and conditions of the covenant by being Torah observant. She fulfilled, she edified, she completely satisfied, she imparted an abundance of that which was valuable and empowering and satisfying upon those individuals. And that was the very argument that the rock, Shimon Kefesh, used against Paul. And what's amazing is that in the land, amongst the disciples and those that they had witnessed to, those who had come to embrace Yahusha as the Messiah, the work of Yahweh, as Yahweh saving us, that the way they were equipped, the way they were edified, the valuable empowerment that occurred to them is that in keeping with Shavuah, which is the promise of the Shabbat, the fourth of the seven Mikre, the fourth of four that was fulfilled in the fourth millennia of human existence apart from the garden, she enabled them to more completely understand the Torah and to convey this understanding and this knowledge to non-Yehudim. Now, they could already communicate it to Yehudim, to Yisraelites, because they spoke Hebrew, and the Yisraelites understood Hebrew. There was Yisraelite speaking to Yisraelite, and Hebrew speaking to Hebrew in Hebrew. But to for a fisherman to convey these truths that Yosha had conveyed to them in Hebrew, in other languages, they needed empowerment. They needed the ability to communicate. And so the set-apart spirit provided them with that capability, and they were able to speak the languages of all of the surrounding Gentile countries. And that was used as an argument against Shaul. That how in the world can it be that God chose you exclusively to speak to the Gentiles when his specific empowerment of us on Shavuah was to speak their languages? And you're crazy. And that is what's being conveyed here. And that was done in the land. It was done in Jerusalem, in the heart of the land. And all this was done so that La Yada Eth, so that everyone might know, that they might be familiar with, that they might approach Yahweh's manifestation of power and glorious presence and abundant value. Yahweh's presence existed in the land and nowhere outside of the land. During we're talking about the fulfillment of the Moed. Yahweh's already dated this. It was 666 years from the time that Chabaouk was inspired to the time that Paul wrote his letter, but he specifically said that this was going to occur during the fulfillment of the Moed. And during the fulfillment of the Moed, Yahweh's manifestation of power and glorious presence became manifest in the land by way of the set-apart spirit. It's the set-apart spirit that changed that child into the very son of Yahweh, the living manifestation of Yahweh. And when she departed, then the body of Yosha could succumb as the Passover lamb without God dying. God simply separated himself from him. And it was that manifestation of power that was provided by the set-apart spirit. And then the set-apart spirit on Shavuah, on 7 sevens later, enabling those members of the covenant to convey this message so that when Yahweh returned to this very same place, he's not coming to Rome, he's not coming to Washington, he's not coming to London, he's most certainly not coming to Paris, he's coming to Jerusalem. And this manifestation of power enables all of us to approach Yahweh at that time. Similar to the rain, the waters providing a covering for the sea, because that's the nature of the set-apart spirit. Source of life, source of cleansing. Yahweh has a lot more to say about Shaul. And while it's important for us to move on and continue to expose how Paul convicted himself with his own contradictory and inaccurate words, we'd be remiss if we didn't state and share a couple of additional thoughts. In the first, we find the prophet Chabaouk not only warning us about Shaul's profuse venom and his perverted sexuality, and Paul was venomous and he was perverted. He addresses Shaul, Paul, little and lowly reputation, which is, when Shaul, which means question him, changed his name to Paulos. Paulos in Latin means little and lowly. That's why Yosha in the Sermon on the Mount referred to him, the one who would dismiss the Torah as little and lowly. He's calling him Paul. In addition to his animosity towards circumcision, that's all that's going to be brought up. So, from Shaul and question him to Paulos and lowly and little moniker, from poisonous toxins and an unacceptable approach or designation to the sign of the covenant, this is an indicting summation of Paul's religious legacy. It says, whoa. Oi is the Hebrew word. This is a strong warning. To the one who causes and allows his companions and countrymen to drink, thereby associating them with this antagonizing venom upon you, this serpentine toxin, which is displeasing and antagonistic, but also intoxicating for the purpose of looking at their genitals. You will get your fill of shame and infamy. You will hold a little and lowly status instead of honor and glory. Choosing to intoxicate, in addition, you also elect to show them unacceptable, going around over their choice not to be circumcised. Upon you is the binding cup of Yahweh's right hand, serving as a metaphor for judgment. Therefore, public humiliation and a lowly status will be your reputation. Chabaouk, embrace this, Habakkuk 2:15 and 16. Oh boy, God is specific. Whoa. There are not a lot of oys, woes in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, but they exist. We spent a considerable time discussing one of those woes at the beginning of Yeshaya, Isaiah, the 18th chapter, where Yahweh is addressing the United States and saying, this is a strong warning. Whoa. What you're doing is reprehensible. It's disgusting. And I'm warning you. Woe to the one who causes and allows his companions and countrymen to drink, thereby associating them with antagonizing venom, intoxicating for the purpose of looking at their genitals. Now, the word chosen for antagonizing venom is chima. It's the poisonous and serpentine toxin which injures and antagonizes, making a person displeasing and antagonistic. You know, a Christian is antagonistic to the very God they claim to love because they're opposed to his testimony, they're opposed to his Torah, they're opposed to and never answer his invitations to meet. As a matter of fact, Christianity is a perfect satanic retort to Yahweh's plan. You see, Satan is going to spend all eternity in Sheol, separated from Yahweh, and for providing this serpentine toxin to the world. And Paul claimed to be possessed by Satan. Now read 2 Corinthians, the end of the letter, says it explicitly. And what Satan created through Paul and Christianity was a fixation on what happened on Passover and a complete ignorance. In fact, a total avoidance of what happened on matzah. And if a person were to capitalize on Pesach, where the sacrificial lamb is slain as the doorway to life, and not answer Yahweh's invitation on the called out meeting of matzah, where we are perfected, where the fungus of religious and political yeast is removed for us so that we look perfect in God's eyes, then they become eternal, just like Satan, but eternally separated from Yahweh, in a place that bears the same name as the architect of this religion, Sheol. And so, by focusing on the death of the Passover lamb and completely skipping over and negating the value of matzah where we are perfected, Paul created the most deadly of all venom. That's Satan's ultimate dream, is that God's creation would spend eternity with him. And Sheol, misery loves company. Now, as for the Pauline doctrine, it's beyond being venom. It is intoxicating. You know, just look at the billions of people who have been intoxicated by it, who have lost the ability to think, to exercise good judgment. That's what a toxin does. And when you're intoxicated, you can't respond appropriately. Your judgment is impaired. Pauline doctrine, because it not only diminishes the value of Yahweh's Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and the instructions and invitations that Yahweh provides, it demeans them. And if you don't have good information, and if good information is repudiated and it's replaced by syrupy words that, you know, that go down sweetly but that are deadly, then what you have is people intoxicated by them. You know, you look at Adolf Hitler and what he said. What he said was pretty stupid. But his style of saying them was intoxicating. Paul is very much like that. What he said is unbelievably irrational, ignorant, stupid. But the way that he phrased it was intoxicating. Now, for the purpose of looking at their genitals, there's two ways you can look at this. And I think both were intended. The first way is, of course, Yahweh explained that they go on about circumcision. And that was where Paul drew his line in the sand. He demeaned the Torah by calling it of the flesh because he said that the circumcision makes it of the flesh, and anything of the flesh is evil. And so Paul created his gospel of faith in grace as of spirit and good, and the Torah, because of circumcision, as fleshy and therefore bad and enslaving. And so in his first letter, Paul not only demeans circumcision, the last paragraphs of his letter, Paul actually takes away the pen from whoever was writing these letters for him and says, this is now in my hand, this is my handwriting, and I want to tell you that circumcision is awful. Circumcision is counterproductive. And yeah, it was really clear. He says, if you're a man and you're not circumcised, you are not going to benefit from Pesach. You are not going to benefit. In fact, you should not participate in Pesach because you're not a member of the covenant, and it's going to be counterproductive for you. And he said that, you know, the promise that uncircumcised men are going to be allowed into heaven is one of the greatest crimes ever perpetrated by religious individuals. You know, if you want to participate in the covenant and you're a man, you need to be circumcised. Period. End of conversation. It's a sign of the covenant. And so this purpose of looking at their genitals is says that Paul's argument is going to be based upon circumcision. That's first and foremost. But second of all, Paul was a homosexual. You know, when Paul made his statements against circumcision, and he says that circumcision was counterproductive, the first thing that he did after the Jerusalem summit was to go back and personally circumcise his lover, Timothy. Timothy is the only person that Paul ever loved. And this is inferring that Paul's love for Timothy, and the reason that Paul was never married, the reason that Paul never knew the love of a woman, is because he loved this man instead. And that, by the way, was extremely common in Rome. You know, you look at Hadrian, who would be in Yahweh's all-time most disgusting five humans who ever lived. Hadrian had a male lover. Very common amongst Romans at that time. Now, I personally don't care. And Yahweh made his statements about his view of homosexuality and its corruptive nature on the covenant message. And there's no disputing that. But the fact is here, there is the underlying testimony that Paul was fascinated with the male genitalia, and this looking at their genitals, it's the male genitalia here. Goes on to say, you will get your fill of shame and infamy, a little and lowly status instead of honor and glory. Both Yahweh and Yahusha refer to Paul as little and lowly. They do so because after naming Paul by name, which was Shaul, which is means to question him, Paul changed his name to Paulos, which in Latin means little and lowly. And he says, yeah, nice choice, because you're going to be considered little and lowly. Yahusha in the Sermon on the Mount said that those who would in any way negate the Torah, as Paul did, would be named little and lowly. He's called Paul in heaven. And all of this is Paul claimed that he was given this glorious honor. Well, Yahweh begs to differ. We'll return. By choosing to intoxicate, this is in the call imperative. In addition, you also elect to show them as unacceptable, going around about their choice not to become circumcised. So there's two parts of this that are really insightful. One is, God told us that should we be curious as to whether Paul chose to lead people astray deliberately regarding circumcision and the covenant and the Torah and the invitations and the like, or whether he was misled, this says that by using the imperative is an expression of volition, that Paul chose to intoxicate. He decided to actually inebriate. It was his choice. He wasn't compelled into doing it. He wasn't forced into doing it. He met with Satan on the road to Damascus, but he chose to be demon-possessed. It was his choice. It was his choice to mislead. And it was also his choice to focus on circumcision and his opposition to circumcision. This actually says, choosing to deploy circular reasoning and altering people's perspective regarding their decision to remain uncircumcised for religious reasons. And you have chosen to actually make them unacceptable. Niphil, imperative, and call imperative. There's two verbs here, ariel, mukab. So we have here the fact that for religious reasons, Paul and his audience wanted his audience to remain uncircumcised for religious reasons, and for religious reasons, his Gentile audience, which was primarily Greeks, wanted to remain uncircumcised. The Greeks, had this whole Gnostic thing of the flesh and the spirit, and the flesh was imperfect. And the last thing that a Greek would do was to mutilate their flesh. And they thought that circumcision was a mutilating of the flesh. Greeks had men had a fixation on the phallic, and they were not about. For them, the idea of circumcision was appalling. And so Paul knew that if he was going to appeal to his target audience, Gentiles, he was going to have to create a religion that was in opposition to circumcision. Moreover, circumcision was a requirement of the covenant, Pauline doctrine, to mislead, to prevent anyone from forming a relationship with God. Pauline doctrine would be opposed to circumcision. I mean, Paul's antagonism to circumcision is absolute, unequivocal proof that he was not speaking for the God who said that you must be circumcised to participate in the covenant and to participate in Passover, as well as to enter heaven. And God's not talking spiritually here. He says circumcised of the flesh and the spirit. So it's obvious that Paul was speaking in conflict with what God had to say. But it's interesting that 666 years before he did so, Yahweh highlighted a specific fulcrum of Paul's argument. And it is circumcision. Make no mistake about it. It is circumcision that Paul uses to destroy the original covenant, to destroy the Torah, to destroy Yahweh's testimony, to demean all of them. It is circumcision. And he chose circumcision because it fed his Gnostic beliefs. And Paul's letters are Gnostic. He chose circumcision because he knew that being uncircumcised would appeal to his audience, which was Gentiles, particularly Greeks. He knew that that by choosing circumcision, he would differentiate his new religion from Yahweh's covenant family. And he deliberately chose it. And he also knew that the Greeks would love him for it. And they did. Up to a point, anyway. So, this is, it's hard to look past the fact that Yahweh has been so explicit in his prophecy, so detailed in his prophecy, telling us exactly what Paul would say to intoxicate his audience, and even describing his motivations in the process. So we'll return to this and complete our analysis of what Yahweh had to say through his prophet, Chabaouk, when Shattering Mist continues tomorrow. May God bless.